Welcome to Oh This World. This is a podcast for those inclined to take action.
In season one, we identified what each of us can do as individuals to hold our elected officials accountable in the age of coronavirus.
Now, with an election approaching, we're focused on the big picture.
For the rest of 2020, we will dedicate each month to an urgent issue facing Texas and America.
We will interview activists, thinkers, and citizens about how to engage on the biggest challenges facing the country.
And we will spotlight a book that tackles each topic head-on. I'm Antoinette Perez.
And I'm Lucas Schaefer. We're friends, engaged citizens, and activists here in Austin, Texas.
Our mission is to help Texans and people across the country build an America that leaves no one behind.
So wash your hands, grab a drink, and join us for Oh This World. Hello and welcome to Oh This World. I am Lucas Schaefer. I, Antoinette, am currently in the bathroom. I'm in a bathroom. How are you?
Super. Do you know that when I was in high school, as a high school musician of very modest means, the place where you were supposed to record your audition tapes, because back then they were still on cassette tapes, you recorded your audition tapes in the bathroom. Did you know that?
I did not know that. Greg, my husband, and I have been for 3 weeks watching my mother-in-law's dog, her wonderful dog, and this is the quietest place.
Your recording studio has moved to the best audio room you could imagine, the bathroom.
Yes, and I do want to tell listeners that our, you know, schedule was a little bit wonky the last few weeks, in part because we have not been both in Austin, not that we meet, you know, we're still virtual, but all of this is to say we did do an interview recently that has not aired yet, and this is when I found the bathroom because we started the interview and it was too loud, and so off to the bathroom I went. So I would just like to thank that guest in advance. I mean, I thanked her at the time, but hopefully, I mean, it, you know, it's a nice bathroom. I'm not like sitting on the toilet, but I'm in a bathroom.
And I would tell you if he was, but he's not.
Yes, we can see. This is why we don't have a YouTube. So Antoinette, we had our White Fragility book club episode extravaganza a couple weeks ago.
We discussed the book a couple weeks ago.
Then we were supposed to have a guest the next week, but we got into COVID. You know, it's a pandemic. We are in a pandemic, so I offer zero apologies.
Yes.
Also, if you have been thinking, I want to do the Patreon, but, you know, these guys are so inconsistent with the schedule now, which is really not, this is our first inconsistency like ever. I do just want to point out that the Patreon is by episode. So like no one was charged
for a lack of episodes or for
a dollar last, because it's most people pay a dollar an episode and no one was charged last week. Okay. So we have a great interview that you did, Antoinette, that we're going to talk about. As we lead into that, you and I have not had a sit down in a couple weeks. I know you have activism updates. I have activism updates. What is going on in the life of Antoinette Perez?
Yeah, I think you and I are engaged in many of the same activities that our listeners probably are. One that was
screaming into a bag and.
Yes, and then furiously typing on the keyboard at Twitter. One unusual event that I helped to organize was a rally for Texas at the Senate level. So this was about educating people on Senator John Cornyn's terrible record behavior. Yes, good for you. Boo hiss.
Was this a was this an in-person?
This was all virtual, as as most of our, I think almost all of our stuff, at least here in Texas, everything that I've seen is virtual. So we had, you know, I don't remember offhand. I want to say there were like 50 people that attended the Zoom. I remember I looked at it on my laptop, and on your laptop in gallery view, you can see 25 participants at a time. And I had two pretty much full windows of participants. Very lively chat box. A lot of the folks that attended remembered pieces of his record. But, you know, with a lot of politicians right now, the bad news is stacked so high that they can only see a couple months deep, and we forget the transgressions of the past. So there were a lot of, ooh, I forgot about that in the chat box.
Can I just, so I'm curious about this, and we can talk in a minute after we talk about Cornyn Fest about an article in the Statesman today that put me into a damn fury relating to this, but yes.
Well, I mean, let's talk about it now, because that's really all I had to say. That was a fairly large project. It had a lot of video components, which, again, moving into COVID, we're all adapting and doing new things. So I had not done sort of a mixture of live and video. That's all I really wanted to say about that.
But this is my question, because in a live protest, right? Because, like, you and I have gone, you know, there have been protests outside, you know, senators' offices, or you and I have gone to meet with a senator's staff, things like that, which is obviously isn't a protest. I mean, in those things, the senator or the staff or the congressperson or whoever is sort of stuck dealing with you, whether they want to be or not. I mean, I'm curious what kind of the purpose of this was, because Cornyn himself presumably could just say, well, I'm obviously going to ignore this because it's online.
Well, the name of it, it wasn't a protest, it was a rally. So that's really what it is rallying the progressives, rallying the people, and presenting every attendee with a giant menu of options of things to do. And I don't think that people are at a loss for things to do right now. I think that we are living in an age where we all have to do a little bit more than we think we can pretty much every day for the next 60 days or so. Until this election happens, and then we all collapse in a heap on November 4th. But the point being, we were encouraging people to try to stretch just a little bit, to do a little bit more to unseat John Cornyn from the Senate in November.
Okay, so it was rallying the troops. It was getting people on the same page. Mm-hmm. Love it.
Yep, it's great.
Okay, what about I'm doing you? Okay. Okay, political reporter for the Austin American-Statesman, Jonathan Tidelove. I went on like a Twitter tear on this person today.
Yes.
And I don't really know. I mean, we've met, but I don't know him. I'm not sure he would know who I am. I mean, we've, you know, seen each other at things. But I just want to preface this by saying, like, I understand the job of a journalist is not easy. It is, everyone is attacking you from all sides. Everyone's working the refs. I'm assuming you're not paid all that much. I mean, maybe he is. I don't know. Jonathan, I know you're not listening, but Jonathan, we have to talk.
You gave that ponytail a pretty good yank today.
So he has this article in the Statesman that's about how Wendy Davis and Chip Roy, the two candidates in Texas 21, are taking different approaches to door-to-door canvassing. Now, Antoinette, you and I in 2018, we were kind of like canvassing buddies, which, and for when we get back to door-to-door canvassing, if ever, I highly recommend this, because find a friend, do it with friends, do it with other people you know and like, and try to do it in your actual neighborhood, because it really was fun. You know, you and I went out a bunch of times for...
it was fun, and you knew all the coffee places to go to in between or afterward or whatever. It was great.
So we had a great time. I wouldn't say... I'm not a person who would say, like, oh, canvassing is, like, the most fun in the world. But, you know, it's we know it's effective, or we think it's effective, and you and I had a lot of fun with it. So I'm pro-canvassing, just in general. Mm-hmm. But basically, this article was about the fact that the Democrats have said, you know, we're in a hot spot. We're in Texas. We're just not going to go knock on people's doors, because It makes them uncomfortable. It puts our canvassers at risk. It puts the people at the doors at risk. Who knows who's wearing a mask? Blah, 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 blah. Right? I mean, I would feel weird if someone came to my door at this point.
I wouldn't answer the door. Right. I don't answer the door.
Right. So Chip Roy has taken a different approach because he does not care who lives or dies as long as we continue to put food on his family's table. Mm-hmm. I'm not bitter. It's fine. And they had this, it was a fairly straightforward article at first, mm-hmm. But I just want to call your attention to one line that started me down the path to fury with Jonathan Tylove, which was after explaining that Wendy Davis has decided for the health of the constituents in her district that she'll be phone banking, she'll be text banking, she'll be getting out there, you know, and talking to people on Zoom and in all of these other ways. Jonathan Tylove writes, Chip Roy refuses to concede the pandemic that much power or yield the high ground to the virtual world. So this was the initial thing that set me off. Giving the pandemic power, the man has undermined public health officials. He's made fun of masks. He's politicized masks. He's promoted miracle cures. He's spread disinformation. It's not some strong, tough pose to be like, I'm pretending this doesn't exist. And the whole article, there were just so many little things where Chip Roy was taken at his word. Mm. He at one point references, oh, he's driven across the state despite having a bad back. And it's like, wait a second. This man, Chip Roy, skipped a USPS vote. He skipped a vote that he didn't want to take with the excuse, oh, I have sciatica, so I couldn't go to DC. Give me a damn break. This man was at a fundraiser the night before. This is, you know what's happening right now? I'm like, I know this so well, and I'm so infuriated by it that I might not even be making sense. But basically, I know we have a lot of other stuff, but I just want to get this out there because I do think it's important. When the Democrats reconvened Congress to vote on USPS and on funding USPS and getting that ship straight because Trump was intentionally trying to create problems, I believe 6 different Texas Republicans miraculously couldn't make it to the vote because they obviously didn't want to vote for it mm-hmm. because it doesn't help them when people are voting by mail, but they also didn't want to be on the record as voting against it because they would get bad press because mm-hmm. there's no excuse for destroying USPS. So Chip, miraculously, his sciatica was acting up and couldn't. He loves to stand up for America, but apparently he couldn't even stand up. And this is my problem with this. One is that the night before he was at a fundraiser, mm-hmm. standing up perfectly straight. Mm-hmm. There are pictures. In fact, it was a fundraiser that is now under investigation because it was in Travis County with more than 50 people, which you're not allowed to do right now.
Right.
Anyways, so again, you know, Tylove just takes at face value that this guy has a bad back, but he's still driving across the district. He's never shown up in Austin for all of his driving across the district. And the other thing that annoyed me about this is he's against paid sick leave. So anyone else with a bad back who couldn't go to work one day would just not get paid. Mm-hmm. But Chip continues to be paid. All of this is to say, and this is what I wanted to bring it back to, because I'm not just on here to rag on Jonathan Tylove, who seems like a perfectly friendly man. But I do think it's important for all of us, not just those of us with an Oh, This World podcast, when we see this coverage that is framing the election in ways we don't like, mm-hmm. I think it's important we create our own content, whether mm-hmm. that's just going on social media or whether it's what we did last week with Chipocalypse 2, where we, and if you haven't listened to it, please listen to it. It's episode 2, season 2, where we went through the timeline of how Wendy Davis has responded and how Chip Roy has responded and lay it all out there for people, because I just think the mainstream media is not up to this task. I don't think they're structured to do this. You know, Chip Roy can say something that's just blatantly untrue, but 90% of the time, the reporter is just going to say, well, that's what Chip Roy said. I'm not saying if it's true or not, and move on. And it's like, it's just not useful information. It's not useful information. So all of that's to say, season 2, episode 2, give it a listen. I also wanted to just make two other quick remarks. I said to you, I think we should do a 5-minute intro and get to the interview.
Yeah.
Antoinette's like, oh God, yes. please move it along.
I was just skeptical. I was like, I don't think we can do 5 minutes, my friend.
No, we can't. We haven't spoken in so long. I mean, we've done interviews, but we haven't spoken like...
True.
Two other things I did today that I just wanted to share in case people are interested. One, I signed up to be a damn poll worker on election day. So the thing with this is, if you've ever gone to the polls, which I hope all of you have, in general, I don't think it's stereotyping to say that the people who work at the polls are older because they're retired and they're giving back to the community. But those are not really the people who necessarily should be
out and about in a pandemic.
At risk during a pandemic. So I've signed up. I don't know. I filled out the application. I don't know if I passed the test. I don't know what will happen, but Greg, my husband, and I signed up to do it. And the other thing, I just wanted to give a little shout out to our friend Matt Oliver, who came on this show last season to tell us about
relational organizing.
Because I just signed up for damn Reach.
Woo!
Which is this great program he told us about. We will post in the episode notes a link to that episode that he was on, because now is the time to be getting on Reach if you're not there.
Now is the time. We have a lot of work to do. Many of us are doing what we can, and we have to continue to be creative in our approach to knocking this whole thing down in about 60 days. So
knock it down.
Who
did you talk to? So sadly, this was during our scheduling snafu of August 2020. So I did this last episode, season 2, episode 2, and then you did this interview because we couldn't quite get
our schedules
together. So tell me about this interview, which I've listened to and is excellent.
When we talked about the potential interviews for the book White Fragility, because this podcast really is about civic engagement and activism, it seemed like an obvious choice to try to find a guest who had more expertise, many different multifaceted perspectives on white fragility in activist circles, in volunteer organizations, in advocacy.
Yes.
So there was one person who immediately came to mind, and his name is Alex Montalvo. Alex and I met about 3.5 years ago, when he was founding an indivisible group up in the Fort Worth area, which is where he lives. And I was working on an indivisible group, the one that you and I met through here, Lucas. And Alex and I had gotten connected to share some best practices. So we had, in that spring, had a few conference calls where we were sharing ideas and feedback. And then that summer, he and I organized together for the first time when the Texas legislature called a special session, and a group of us had kind of put together a strategy for advocating during that summer special session. And I got to work with Alex closely. And in fact, over time, he and I have gravitated toward that same group, which is focused on state level advocacy, first and foremost here in Texas.
Yes.
He is beastly. I don't use that word lightly because, I have some beast tendencies myself, but I'm just going to tell you that he's got a brain that processes like a computer can process, just massive amounts of information can go into his head, and he can analyze situations and create systems to make the work simpler, easier, faster. He's just a joy to organize with. And I feel really excited and I'm going to go ahead and use this word, blessed, that the current lead organizing team for the group that I work with the most, he's on it, and he brings such a unique perspective to everything. And then certainly in this interview, he brings a very unique perspective to the topic of white fragility in activist circles.
In activist circles. So that's what you and Alex talked about. So let's take a break and we'll give it a listen.
Alex, welcome to Oh This World. How are you doing today?
Doing great. It is great to be with you and this wonderful podcast that has been created.
It is always great to be with you as well. And you and I have been in some of the same activist groups and circles for a little bit over 3 years now. We first met back in the spring of 2017. And we met basically through our affiliation with different grassroots groups that were involved with the Indivisible movement. But it turns out that you have a much, much, much longer and broader, frankly, base of experience with activism and advocacy. So in terms of your background, could you just tell us a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. So for me, the journey really started a little bit after I turned 30. I remember at a gas station with my wife and had been contemplating a lot of things and ended up telling her, I really think it's time for me to get engaged in the community again. I've been really focused on my career, focused on our family, but something was just gnawing at me. And so I told her, I don't know exactly what this is going to look like, but wanted to definitely clue her into what I was thinking and what I was wanting to do. And very quickly, it turned into pursuing different community conversations and book clubs and things that were happening. And shortly after that, I got connected with an old high school buddy who worked at Tarrant County College, and he was a part of an effort with developing a nonprofit called MANO, which was Men Advancing New Opportunities. And the goal was around bringing Latino males together to help develop the next generation of Latino male leaders and trying to improve college completion rates and things like that. So a lot of lofty goals that the organization had. So serving in that nonprofit was my really first foray in kind of getting back into the community. I then started interacting with the PTA of my daughter's elementary school and realized that there was a big need for engagement with different roles on the board and started learning about that organization. And through those two efforts, just continued to learn who the players were in the community, who the organizations were in the community, and really getting connected with various efforts that were happening within Fort Worth and Tarrant County. That eventually led to me pursuing the fellowship program with Leadership ISD, which is an education advocacy organization. And then serving as a part of their alumni board after my fellowship, and just continuing to take on roles within the community, as well as, you know, shortly after 2016 election, starting to get more involved in civic engagement. I remember my friends and I had made this plan for, you know, our 40-year, when by the time we're 40, what are some of the things we want to accomplish? And I remember noting, like, you know, I want to help with a city council campaign. I want to help with, you know, some state race. And I want to help with a presidential campaign just to kind of learn more about these things. And prior to the 2016 election, I had started you know, I'd helped with the city council campaign, and then very quickly jumped into everything else. And so that plan got accelerated a lot faster than I was expecting.
Right. Right. Thank you. That's a very diverse background. And it sounds like you have been in a variety of different spaces with your volunteer work and your advocacy. I just wanted to kind of recenter the conversation for listeners on that book, White Fragility. So you talked about initially just kind of feeling your way through what was available in your area through book clubs and a little bit more casual sorts of volunteer roles, and then really settling into MONO, which was Latinos, and the end result was serving young Latino men, right? And then you moved into like PTA and then Leadership ISD. Was there a different makeup racially between all of those organizations? Because Fort Worth, frankly, is just much more diverse than where I live in Austin. Or did you find that there was good racial diversity like in every experience that you've had so far?
Well, definitely with MONO, it was, you know, Latino males coming together. And so there was that concentration. And because of that work, that got me connected to a lot of the other Latino leaders in the community and getting to learn about their work and how they were, you know, going about, you know, trying to improve things within their own organizations. And I'm really grateful for that experience and for those connections early on, because it helped me become educated in a way that I don't know if I would have, if I would have jumped straight into the other spaces I ended up getting into. So with PTA, PTA has predominantly been a white environment, mm-hmm. and really trying to elevate, you know, black and brown voices, people of color, has been something that I have been conscious of as I've been working within that space. And then similarly, when I started doing advocacy work through Indivisible, that was a very white space, walking into that work. And you know, there was definitely different experiences within those spaces because of the makeup of the people involved, and to some things were positive in one way, some things were positive and negative in a different way, you know. And so it's been interesting navigating these different spaces and trying to figure out like what is going to be effective for us to get the goal, you know, to get the outcomes and the goals that we're trying to achieve. Mm-hmm.
In your experience, has there been a qualitative difference in the approach to advocacy when you're in a group that's mainly people of color versus a group that has a lot of white volunteers and advocates and activists?
That's a really good question. You know, I think it's unique because with MONO, we were really trying to build something that a lot of us hadn't built before. And so it felt like it was figuring things out as we were going. But trying to lean on the resources that we knew of. And I've seen in other spaces, I'll use Indivisible as an example, where some of that knowledge and information was baked into the effort, because these were people who had this experience prior or understood elements of what they were trying to do, but it was from a different time. And it was them trying to translate what they experienced to the current times, and that created a different clash. And then when it comes to education advocacy and Leadership ISD, you know, they're really intentional around bringing people from different backgrounds who have a desire to be education advocates but may not work in education. And so that created a lot of different conversations and experiences, because some people were better versed in education policy and you know, the trends in education, whereas others were just figuring it out. So it was kind of a mixture within that space. I feel like there were different kinds of support in terms of stability within those organizations based on the different makeups. You know, with Indivisible, not as many people, it seemed, had to worry about their day-to-day job because they were either retired or had financial security to a certain extent. And so we were able to go about the work a little differently and think about the work a little differently because of that. Whereas with Mono and with some other efforts, you know, everyone had day jobs. Everyone was trying to do this in addition to, and it was always the challenge of balancing, you know, that work and everything. Mm. So that was probably some of the main distinctions that I can think of.
Yeah. You mentioned something in your response just now that I wonder if we can flesh out a little bit. You said that Leadership ISD makes a concerted effort to bring people in with different points of view. What's been your experience in the variety of groups that you've been involved with, the makeup of those groups in terms of being possibly white-led versus POC-led, and what efforts they made and to diversify? And were those efforts real? Did they follow through on them? How did they stay accountable to them? What work did they do practically to diversify? Because we may have listeners right now that are thinking, my group is really, really white. What now? What do I do?
Yeah, I think with Leadership ISD, they have a lot of efforts around connecting with people within different communities and going to those communities to try to invite them into the fellowship program and into the environment that they've created. You know, they've also had success with their alumni becoming school board members for Fort Worth ISD, and the diversity of our Fort Worth ISD school board is a large part due to the work that Leadership ISD has done. So that was a big part of it in terms of just their recruitment efforts, that they're being intentional on trying to recruit in different communities. But even them, you know, even they have provided feedback, you know, that they're sometimes not getting as much reach within those communities as, let's say, the white communities, because there's just a wealth of people in the white community who want to be involved or become aware because of the other benefits that people see. You know, this is a networking opportunity. This is, you know, getting connected with people in power and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so, so there's definitely been some struggles with still getting enough people of color within the program, with what their goals are. Mm-hmm. And so, but definitely, you know, organizing and recruiting within those communities is really important. And then building relationships with people who are working within those communities has been a big portion. So they lean there on their alumni to help with that recruitment as well. So, you know, as I was recruited by my colleague who I worked with in Mono, you know, I've also recruited others within my network to try to be a part of this program. And so that's been a huge help for their diversity. With groups like PTAs, which I find interesting in terms of how PTAs are recruited, you really see a difference in terms of the privilege of communication, the privilege of information, really make a difference in terms of who's engaged. And so it becomes, you know, it can become very easy for there to be, you know, collections of parents who then are only comfortable talking to each other and don't want to talk to the broader population. And then also, like, when it comes to event planning, because, you know, with PTAs, it is completely volunteer led. It is parents who have maybe have had kids go through the education system, or a lot of new parents who are just wanting to be involved because it's their first child. And so they're still learning how to navigate everything. But you really start to see things surface within that space around biases and just people, prejudices that people have, where I remember getting feedback around Latino parents wanting to be involved with certain events, family events, and their contribution was, you know, to make food or to do different things, and that immediately being rejected because the model was to purchase food from a restaurant or purchase food from a vendor.
Yeah.
And so then there's that feeling of like, I can't get engaged, and there's also not access being made for them to engage. And so there's been a lot of work around trying to be more inclusive, which is the PTA mission and vision, is to be completely inclusive. Mm-hmm. But the practice of it requires people to, you know, to really recognize and to change how they're going about what they would do in their own lives versus what they would do in a diverse population within the school.
I've really only ever had experience in PTA at the single school level, but you have been involved in PTA like at your ISD level, your independent school district, and also at the state, right? So the example that you just gave of, for instance, the potential, let's say in a given school, the Latino family saying, okay, so for this event that's coming up for the school, we want to make and donate food. And then the PTA says, no, we've always bought the food, and so we're going to continue to do it that way. Do you see those types of things also arise at the district level as well as at the state level? Do they look different, feel different? Are they different discussions, or does that not come up there?
Well, you definitely see itself manifest. It manifests itself in different ways, but it really starts to become more prevalent in what the purpose of PTA is seen as. And so there's a couple of things that I've done as I've been involved with PTAs that I tell parents, is that, you know, there's three misconceptions around PTAs that are important for us to overcome. One, that PTAs is a mom's group. Now, PTAs were founded by women. They have been led by women, by the majority, and the majority of members are women. And so it's definitely understandable why that perception is there. But in fact, PTAs are for everybody. PTAs right. are for every parent, every community member to be involved in. And so we have to continue to make sure that we're pushing that forward. And the state at the state level, they've done a great job of trying to make sure that people are approaching that inclusiveness with PTAs by incentivizing more engagement by fathers or male figures and just different community members. And so on the ground, though, it's taken a little bit more time to adopt because there had been habits formed that, mm-hmm. that have prevented that from happening. Mm-hmm. Another thing is that we are a charity, and so that the emphasis becomes around fundraising. You know, we need money to accomplish the things we want to accomplish. And once again, from the state level, which the past president was a Black woman, Sherry Doss, and she really did a great job of transitioning the priorities of PTA to get back to the core of what PTA is, and that's advocacy. Wow. And so while there may be fundraising efforts within PTA, and there may be funds needed to accomplish certain goals, our primary purpose is not to be a charity organization that is just fundraising money to distribute it to their campus. Ultimately, advocacy is our number one priority in our wow. work. And then the other thing is that it's not a social club, exclusively mm-hmm. a social club. While you may create friendships and you may have social events to engage families, the goal of the PTA is not to be primarily just a social club. It is to empower and engage families to advocate for all children so they can reach their potential. And so centering the core of what PTA is has been an effort that I know within our community, within Fort Worth ISD, has been a priority, and it has also been a priority within the state, because that's how you see it surface at the district level or at the state level, is that these are the things that are celebrated, these are the things that are prioritized, versus what the core is, which is advocacy. And so then if advocacy is the core and we're trying to engage and empower all families, and you have a district like Fort Worth ISD where 90% of the students are students of color, mm-hmm. then PTA's work begins to look a lot different than what is assumed, mm-hmm. and even maybe what is seen through like media and things like that.
Right. Robin DiAngelo in White Fragility talks about the prices that we pay for not having cross-racial friendships, for instance. And I think in the context of the discussion we're having right now, I want to explore a little bit the prices that we pay for not having cross-racial membership in our groups. What are some of your observations and experiences in prices that get paid? I do think you've already hinted at some of this, right? You talked about the question of what are we centering? What are we prioritizing? I also heard in your discussion of the PTA, culture change, which it sounds like your last president did a phenomenal and it's seemingly impossible job of doing, which is a culture change on three major points. What do we lose when our advocacy groups don't have the kind of racial diversity that they need?
I think one of the major casualties is we lose sight of what solutions we should be pursuing. And I think COVID is a great example of seeing how parents have reacted to what their needs are within this pandemic. You know, a lot of the push for the conversation around being in school or being virtual, mm-hmm. I think is a big part of that. And so when you are used to having privilege, or you're used to having, you know, everything centered around your experience, which I think a lot of white people have that perspective, then you expect what you want to be what the majority wants. And what we've seen in different communities is when districts or when organizations have asked communities what they're thinking or what they're feeling about how to move forward, a lot of them are feeling unsafe because of what they have seen in their neighborhoods. And in Fort Worth, some of the zip codes that have had the biggest spread of COVID have been in zip codes of people of color. And so when we don't have the membership that is diverse and we don't have the voices that are diverse within our organizations, we risk not understanding what everyone's experience is, and then we risk not solving for things that are for the broader population.
Right.
And it becomes very privileged in terms of what our solutions are that we are pursuing. So I think it's really important that, you know, something that she mentions in her book is the challenge for, you know, white people to listen and to not lead the conversations that are being had, because their experience and what they think is the experience of everybody is just not the case.
Right. Yeah. There's in this book, she talks a little bit about it. And then in a related book that we've mentioned on the podcast before called Waking Up White, Debbie Irving talks about this default mode that white folks often go into, which is that their experience is universal. The white experience should speak for everyone's experience. And I think this is the heart of it, which is when our groups do not have a diverse membership, we don't have all the voices at the table represented, we are only looking at a subset of possible solutions. And if we choose from that very slim subset of possible solutions, we may be picking something that doesn't serve everybody.
Exactly.
Big drawback. All right, very good. So this kind of relates to one of the most salient points that I think Robin DiAngelo hammers home in the last probably third of the book, which is the need for white folks to be able to say, I'm ready to listen, as you just said, and to receive feedback, because sometimes we say things that are, you know, racially not kosher. We need some help and some guidance, and we need to make it okay for other people to address those things with us. I wanted to talk about this concept of comfort versus safety. I thought this was a great point in the book. She says that white people will often say, I don't want to talk about race. I personally don't feel safe talking about race. And she points out that, in fact, white folks in the discussion of race are as safe as anyone could possibly be, and they are confusing comfort with safety. In other words, she's encouraging white folks to say, instead of saying, I feel unsafe in this conversation, to say, I'm uncomfortable, and then to realize that it's okay to be uncomfortable. It's necessary to be uncomfortable in order to have the conversations that we need to have. Have you had any specific experiences in any of your advocacy volunteer work where white folks, white progressives in particular, have maybe been called out for inadvertent things that they've said, biases that come to the surface? Were they open to the feedback? How did that unfold?
Well, there's probably a good selection of experiences to pick from. I think one that I'll lean into is around voter engagement work, around electoral work, around trying to get people to get involved in whether it's the local races that are happening or statewide races. And just getting people civically engaged. You know, there's definitely been experiences that I've had where we need to expand who is engaged in the politics of today. And we are in a system that has created dynamics where people of color don't feel like their voice matters, and they don't engage because of what has been experienced by their parents or by generations before them. And so they have gotten disenfranchised, you know, and this could be through gerrymandering to, you know, who represents them, to registering to vote, to getting information about candidates. We have a system that makes it difficult for a person to just know it all of a sudden. And so when we're trying to pursue engagement, to have the potential of electing people that we feel are more representative of the inclusive, let's say, progressive perspective that we may be pursuing. I have found that when there are white progressives who are well-intentioned, decide that their path to victory is the path that we need to take, where when you look at the path that they are prescribing, it has not led to victory over the past several cycles. That can get frustrating, and they almost view it as, well, it wasn't successful because we were here, but you weren't here as a Latino, or whether it's a Black community or a Brown community or anybody else. But now that you're here, our plan is going to work. Mm-hmm. And it's them not understanding that we need to it's not even rebuilding. We need to build like the initial infrastructure that has never been there in order for there to be a long lasting engagement with voting or electoral politics or civic engagement. And them not understanding that we just need to turn on the switch that's always been there and everything will, versus no, we need to actually build something new in order for us to get to where we're trying to get. And it's not going to be through the traditional means that you've experienced civic engagement. It's going to be what is needed by these communities. I think is an example that I've seen with civic engagement work, why we're still struggling to connect with communities and why people are still resistant to engaging with politics in general, but in advocacy and everything like that.
Wow. I wrote down, we need to build something new. Can you speak just a little bit more on that?
Let's see. Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the expectations we have of what we identify as civic engagement. For a lot of people, it's just, well, we just need to vote. It's going back to that experience that I feel like at my age, we've experienced this before. If we just vote for the right person, then this is going to work and it's going to take care of itself because mm-hmm. those people are there to do the work that are there. But with the way that money is in politics now and the way that our representation is openly not trying to represent their entire constituency, then we need to have an honesty in civics and advocacy that has not been there. And I think, one thing that is elevated a lot is the tactics and the work that has been done by AOC and the squad in terms of trying to engage their constituents and how they interact with their constituents. And I think we see examples of how this is different and this is new and what is needed to elevate the communities that we want to be involved in civic engagement and advocacy. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where, for some, when we have conversations and it's predominantly a white audience, there is a certain nostalgia that they still have because traditionally in the organizations I've been, it's been an older crowd. Right. It's been an older white crowd that has been involved. And they're still thinking, well, we just need to kind of rinse and repeat what has been done previously. And there could be arguments of whether that ever truly worked back then either,
Right.
And so.
You're giving me a lot to think about. I really appreciate this. I just wanted to ask, I guess, one final question, because one of my favorite things about this interview is that it's taken on a direction that I don't think I predicted it was going to go for me personally and what I'm getting out of it. So my last question isn't what I thought it was going to be. It's a totally new last question. Let's just assume that we know that we are throwing all of our resources currently into a group that is advocating, that is active, that is predominantly white. We know that diversity is required. And let's say that we decide the next step is to really work hard to build a multiracial coalition. What advice do you have for someone who might be listening that recognizes the lack of diversity and wants to go out and help to build a bigger, broader, more diverse coalition?
It's a really good question. I think we have to redefine what we count as victories. You know, I think it's really easy to weigh all of your emotions and all of your efforts on whether a seat is won for your cause or not. And that's definitely important. I mean, you need to have the people elected that you are wanting to be a part of the change that's needed. But what our current system is still doing is that it's still saying, okay, well, based on historical data, this is winnable and this is winnable. So all my investments are only going to go in these spaces.
Yes.
And what we end up doing is we end up perpetuating what already exists. Mm-hmm. And so we're not actually changing anything because we are basing it on a faulty foundation. And so that means that we need to engage communities and educate ourselves and everybody involved on how to engage, how to be civically engaged that's going to work for everybody. That is not only based on whether we win this election or win this seat or win this particular cycle. It has to be bigger than that. And because once again, it's about building something new. It's not about just flipping a switch, because the switch that already exists is a switch of white privilege and white supremacy and centered around whiteness. It's not a switch that is engaging the community, the diverse community, the people of color, black community, brown community, everybody else. And so if we have to build something new, then that means we have to do the organizing, do the work, develop, support, invest in the communities so that the representation is from those communities. And that's how we're going to get to where, you know, we're going to have lasting change. You know, too often, you know, we're still looking to try to make traditional investments and have traditional outreach. And I think a great example in our advocacy work is when I learned about the van system and when I learned about what candidates were using and how they were choosing who to knock, what doors to knock on. Mm-hmm. And we had conversations with an Indivisible Space. Well, like, we exist because we're supposed to be filling the gap. And so if all we do is continue to follow the playbook of knocking on doors that have shown that these are the doors that are reliable, then we're not building anything new. We're not going to have lasting change. We're simply trying to rely on what has already been there. And that wasn't enough in the first place. So how do we go about actually engaging the community? And that's why what we deem as victories and what we deem as success has to be identified differently. And because what we measure is what motivates us. Mm-hmm. And how we measure it is what's going to motivate us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, until we have registration numbers at a certain part, at a certain number or whatever that goal is in any community, and especially in diverse communities and black and brown communities, and until then we have voter turnout, getting upset over who's elected is in my opinion, going to be a constant frustration, and any success in that space is going to be temporary because it's just going to go back. Mm-hmm. And that's what we see. Mm-hmm. We don't see that the majority of what Americans are wanting is being pursued, whether those people are representing us locally or representing us in the state or representing us in Congress. What the majority of Americans are wanting to help solve the issues we're seeing on the ground are just not being pursued in either party in any legitimate way. And so we have to invest and we have to understand what our victories are, and they have to be much more than just who gets elected.
Right. Wow. I mean, this goes back in some ways to the heart of what civic engagement means now compared to what it meant maybe 30 or 40 years ago. And 30 or 40 years ago, you could reasonably maybe just vote and get on with your life. And today, that's not enough. It's just not enough. Voting is just one small piece of the puzzle. And really staying in this for the long-term win, staying in this for the long-term vision of success for our country and for our communities is critical.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thanks for having me. I'm so grateful to be a part of what you guys are building and creating. It's exciting to hear the conversations that y'all are having. And, you know, it's exciting that we are continuing to figure this out. And I believe that we will figure this out. It just may be a little harder than we all have initially thought when we first jumped in.
It's 2020. That's the theme of the year. It's just going to take more.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my God, Antoinette, that was fantastic. Thank you. And thank you, Alex, for speaking with us. So you did this interview 4 days ago because we're not, you know, these are not happening the day of. Right. I'm wondering, a few days have passed, you had the conversation, what has kind of stuck with you the most? What's our upshot? What's our takeaway? What's our...
Well, I said it toward the end of the interview, and I'll say it again, that the questions that I had prepared and that I went into the interview with, I kind of scrapped by the end of it. And it's not that the questions weren't great. It was that he was heading in a direction that I thought was very useful, but I didn't predict we were going to go. And a big takeaway for me was when he talked about his experience at the state-level PTA, and he talked about three big cultural changes that happened for the PTA that were driven by a past president, which was around diversifying the public's view of the primary gender of PTA volunteers, to change the emphasis away from fundraising and to really center the organization on a different purpose and a different mission. And then also to be clear that PTAs are not social clubs, they are advocacy groups. So that stuck with me for a long time after. And I think that you and I, in this discussion of white fragility, I keep coming back to what are the individual steps that we need to do. But then I also, out of that interview with Alex, came out of it thinking, how can each of these steps that we take add up to cultural change in our organizations, in our communities, in our neighborhoods? How can we affect cultural change? Because that's what it's going to take to create lasting change.
Yes. Well, and this is a theme both with this interview we just heard and also with the interview next week, I feel like is... how does individual action relate to systemic change? Right? I mean, that's kind of a core.
Yes. Thing. And I don't... I still have to think about this one. I don't know if I have some strong conviction right now that individual action taken over and over again in the absence of a longer term policy or legislative strategy will get the job done. But I also believe that the reverse can't happen effectively either. In other words, we can't just be fighting for policy and legislation that will integrate our communities better. Like, we actually have to be doing things differently. And yes, we will talk about that on the next episode a little bit more.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts on this interview with Alex? Any big things that you
heard? I just thought what was useful about it was the sort of breadth of his experience. It was not just one you know, it was indivisible. It was PTA, et cetera, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. Mm-hmm. So to me, I just thought that was useful in terms of thinking about the culture of these different institutions and organizations. I just thought it was a great interview. Nice job, Antoinette.
Yeah, thank you. It was really great having this sort of a focused conversation with him, because when he and I get sort of philosophical about organizing and activism in like our regular conversation, we obviously don't have like a clock going. So we just sort of talk as much as we can. And then somebody says, hey, I have to go have dinner or whatever. It was a unique experience. I'm really glad to have had that discussion with him. And the other thing at the end of the interview that I realize when I look at my notes, I kind of wrote a few different things down about was his emphasis on the work that we're doing not ending in an electoral victory or any sort of electoral outcome, that we really need to be doing this work for the long haul, and that all of those electoral, whatever their outcomes, are just milestones along the way. And it makes a lot of sense, because you and I, like, the reason why we've been doing this podcast is we live in Texas. We have to live here. So we need to make this better for all of us, all across Texas, all the time. It's different sometimes when, you know, you and I as unpaid grassroots organizers and activists, like when we have people that drop in who are, you know, paid campaign organizers or paid field directors from different advocacy groups, sometimes they relocate here. And I love a lot of them. I appreciate the jobs that they do. And then after a year, they get relocated somewhere else. Sure. And it's important for us as the people who live here and whose quality of life is affected by all of these things to make sure that we are plugged in, not just for the election, but for ever and ever and ever.
Speaking of which, yes. Dear listeners, do you know what I'm going to say?
No.
What I'm going to say is you listened to a little banter between myself and Antoinette. You listened to this fantastic interview. If you have thoughts, Antoinette,
what do they do?
Give us a call, 702-907-RAGE, RAGE, 702-907-RAGE. Ooh. Let us know what you thought. And then on the last episode of this kind of
cycle,
our white fragility cycle. So we're going to have another interview next week. And then the week after that, we are going to play these responses, talk about them. We have already gotten people calling 702-907-RAGE. They have left messages on the Rage line.
Yes.
One is a prank call from my husband pretending to be a Chip Roy supporter. But we'll probably play. You know what? If we can get one more patron on Patreon between now and then, I will play it. So if you've been thinking about it,
look at
if you've been thinking about it, this is your prize. 702-907-RIDGE. Should we say who's coming on next week, or is it a surprise?
I think we can say it. We've had the interview. We know who it is. No scheduling snafus there.
Yeah, so Angela DeJoseph, who is the producer head of Women of Color Roar
Media.
Mm-hmm. Women of Color Roar Media. Mm-hmm. We had a great conversation, the three of us, about a lot. What did we talk about?
Well,
we talked about everything.
We started out on the topic of the media covering people of color, candidates of color, and it very quickly, because she's so easy to talk to, opened up into white fragility in all of the areas. But that was kind of where we kicked off.
Well, and she, like this is what I have liked about both our interviews so far. These are people with not only deep expertise, but like varied expertise, right? Mm-hmm. She's a writer, she's a producer, she's a media consultant.
Yes.
So she had a lot of, I thought, really interesting insight. And we'll be excited to play that next week. Yeah. Okay. Well,
In the meantime, here's the deal. Oh, This World is here for season two, and we could still use all of your support in all of the ways Lucas has mentioned. Patreon.com/Oh This World Pod. And wherever you're listening, if you haven't done it yet, especially those of you on Apple Podcasts, give us just click the 5-star. Just click it. Just give it a little clicky click. If you want to, you know, add a sentence, do a little review, help people find us.
Before people do that, I'm turning the channel because we're going into the thing we say every time. Can I just say one thing?
What?
Just one reminder, which is that last season we had a call to action at the end of every episode for something you can do to affect political change now. Mm-hmm. And I just want to remind people, because it's been a couple weeks, we are not doing that this season because there's just an expectation that we are phone banking, we are text banking, we are doing all the things. So if you are listening and not doing the things, do the damn things.
Do the things.
Oh, this
one. Do some relational organizing. Do some phone banking. Do some text banking.
Sign up to be a poll worker.
Do more. One more thing than you think you can do. Write a postcard. Do it.
Write a postcard.
Yeah. Send us an email. ohthisworldpod@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram @ohthisworldpod. And the hotline, Lucas.
702-907-RAGE. And you know what? I don't have my phone in front of me, so I don't know what numbers RAGE are. Do you know? Do you have your phone? Because some people may not have the letters or may just want the numbers.
702-907-7243.
Give us a call. Vent, RAGE. Jonathan Tyliff, if you're listening to this, defend yourself, man. Get on here.
I hope you're.
We'll have you as a guest.
Not sore.
I would have him as a guest anytime.
All right. That's it for this week, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. See you next week.
So I will be out of the bathroom.
Bye.
Bye.